Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In this month's program, we meet a cattle rancher turned winemaker. He gave up everything to ferment his dream, selling his house and Harley Davidson to open Yellowstone Cellars and Winery in Billings, Montana. First, let's hear about his ranching background, and later in the program, we'll find out more about the wine he's making. Clint Peck, welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky.
Hey, Stella, glad to be here. Yeah, you know my background. I grew up on a small farming and ranching operation, I guess you'd say, in eastern Yellowstone County near Pompey's Pillar.
About 30 miles from here.
Yep, about 30 miles from here. My mom and dad tried to scrape out a living in a very, very small place. They both came from central Montana, the Judith Gap and Garneal area, and then they later, after World War II, settled in eastern Yellowstone County. It was kind of tough times, tough years. We seemed like, as a family, always moving around.
How many of you were there?
Well, there's mom and dad, of course, and then my older sister, Bonnie, who lives in Helena, and my older brother, Ken, who lives in Blaine, Washington. And we'll get back to Ken and his wife, Jill, when we talk about the winemaking.
You were the baby of the family.
I was the baby of the family. We moved around, lived in Laurel for many years. My dad had a gas station in Laurel, and then moved out of state, moved to the state of Washington for a couple years, and I actually graduated high school in Colorado, near Castle Rock, Colorado. And as soon as I graduated high school, in fact, the last day of school was a Friday. I was crossing the Montana border on Saturday.
Oh my,
my diploma caught up with me. I was riding on a ranch at Babb, Montana, up on the Blackfeet Reservation. My diploma caught up with me sometime in August.
How was that, moving around, making new friends, having to reestablish yourself?
You know, I've been asked that question, and I think it helps you learn a lot of social skills because you're always meeting new people. You're the new kid on the block. You're the new kid in class, and you have to, kind of like a boy named Sue, you have to learn how to survive.
Did you like being Sue?
You know, it was all right. It was what it was, you know, and my parents we moved around a lot. My parents never offered any apologies. It's just what we did as a family to stay together. My dad was moving around from jobs and
he sounded like he was multiverse, very talented, able to do anything.
My dad was, at the end of the day, my dad was a little old Montana cowboy. He lived with me the last 6 years of his life. The last year, I was pretty much his caregiver. And the lessons my dad taught me and the little sayings in life.
Such as?
I carry those with me literally every day. And my dad was a grand, grand person. My mom died 10 years before he died, and he had a real tough time after being married to my mom. I think they were married 54 years.
Yeah, just life partners.
Yep, exactly.
What were some of those sayings that you carry around?
Oh, you know, one of the big ones, and the staff at the winery give me a bad time about it, but there's one that don't ever say whoa in the middle of a mud hole. You know, when things are kind of getting bogged down and tough, you don't give up. You just slog on through it. You drop it down a gear and you find traction. You figure out how you're going to get out of that mud hole.
Well, that must have come in handy in many of your careers in the future.
Oh, gosh, I guess, yeah. Dad was a kindly man, but he was just so thoughtful. And I'm thankful that till the day he died, he had all of his faculties about him. He died with literally a Miller Lite in his hand as we were sitting watching TV one evening.
I could see it in your eyes that you just have this fondness for him.
Yeah, yeah. And my mom, she kept us all in stitches. We teased her terribly, and as boys and my dad, and we'd give her a bad time about just about everything she did. And I think she loved that attention. And I think she would do goofball things just to see what our reaction would be and how we would come back at her about that.
Oh, that's super endearing there. From there, you went and got a degree in agricultural production from Montana State University in Bozeman.
I did, yeah. And then that was a great experience. Right out of college, I was hired to be the cow foreman on a ranch south of Cascade, Montana, on the Dana Ranch for a very, very brilliant man by the name of Dr. David Cameron, who was a geneticist, a evolutionary geneticist at Montana State, taught in the biology department. I worked for David for quite some time as cow foreman on that ranch. Moved around working on ranches, finally settled pretty much in the Stanford, Montana area, where I was the county extension agent for Judith Basin County for 7 years. And that really, I think, launched me sort of from a worldly standpoint. It really gave me an education in how to deal with people and things and problems and solve problems and help people along the way.
But then you launched from there to do journalism, which did take you out into the world. You went to places across the ocean.
Yeah, that segued into an agricultural journalism career, and I worked for almost 20 years. A lot of it was international agricultural journalism. I specialized in the beef cattle business and in beef production and beef supply chain management. And worked a lot in Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, other areas, Mexico, then Canada, Australia. I did quite a lot of work. And that kind of then led to some, I guess, a bit of a career in beef supply chain management. And then I ended up sort of before the winery business. I was the beef quality assurance specialist for the state of Montana through Montana State University and the Montana Stock Growers Association.
So what were some of your highlights? What were some of your favorite places that you visited?
Oh, gosh. You know, a very good friend of mine who is a Brazilian, lives with her husband in Minneapolis, actually. She has a cattle ranch. She and her family have a cattle ranch in western Brazil. And I've been to Fazenda Viventa several times, working with Renata and her mom and her brother on this ranch, trying to improve it and make it more productive while always trying to look out for the resources, the soil and water resources. And that's probably a highlight of all of that, is being involved in that Brazilian cattle ranch.
Do you speak different languages?
Oh, I speak a little bit of Portuguese. Enough to get me into trouble and make people laugh at me when I'm there. I speak a little bit of Spanish as well, but that really gets me into trouble quite often.
How was it leaving Montana, which, you know, you pretty much stayed in this area of the world and then branching out to other parts?
Well, you know, it was interesting because meanwhile I was leasing a small cattle ranch up in the Bull Mountains northeast of Billings, and I often say that when I wasn't on an airplane chasing stories about cows, I was home on a saddle horse chasing the cows that got away while I was on the danged airplane. And it was, you know, it did get to be a little bit stressful, traveling a lot. Meanwhile, I have to say I helped raise two daughters, Sarah and Ellen, and they still are my rock and my stability as far as bringing me back full round to what's really important in life, and that's family and those kids. But they also appreciated, I think, that at the end of the day, I decided that I was going to settle down from all this sort of globetrotting stuff and stay here in Montana. You know, Stella, after I started the winery, I was, I think, 3 years before I climbed on an airplane again.
Wow. And that was in 2010?
I started the winery in November of 2010.
Why? What was the catalyst for that?
Well, you know, the catalyst was my brother Ken and his wife Jill, who moved out to the state of Washington a long time ago, 30-some-odd years ago. and they both had law enforcement careers, and they retired early. My brother retired early, and he was a chemist by training. And what does a chemist in Washington do but open up a winery? Because winemaking is pretty much all chemistry. So I watched Ken and Jill with their business for several years, and it occurred to me in about 2006 or 7, that this might not be a bad route for me to take. And so I started studying their business a little bit, working with them quite a lot, and in about 2009, I was actually wheels up coming out of Caracas, Venezuela, after a little bit of a tough time in that country. And I kind of said, you know what, this is going to be my last airplane ride for a while. And I came home, started a business plan, worked with my brother on the business plan, and bought the property where I'm located.
But you had to do a few things to be able to buy that property.
Well, I did. Yeah, this is where, you know, it kind of gets interesting. You know, I heard that there's, and you may know more about this than I, that there's an old Chinese curse that says, may you live in interesting times.
And how, why was that so interesting, Clint?
Well, it was interesting because my dad died, and I had a house here in Billings and on the tree streets in Billings. And so I thought, well, heck, and I had some equity in that, and I thought, well, if I'm going to build this winery, I got to have some money. So I sold the house. I had sold my cows. I sold my horses. And then the one that everybody gasps at is when I sold my Harley-Davidson. They're going, oh, my gosh, how could you ever sell a Harley-Davidson? But I did. I gathered up the money enough to buy the property where the winery is located, used that investment, that equity into that land, into that piece of ground, then to leverage to building, constructing the building. I generaled the building. And, yeah, so I sold everything I owned. Still, I opened up my checkbook the 5th of July in 2010 after I had started the winery and kind of was getting things going, trying to figure out sort of where my next step was. I opened up my checkbook and I had $43 to my name.
And we didn't know, Clint.
That's the old don't say woe in the middle of a mud hole thing.
So you forged forward.
Yeah, you did. I did. And people often would come to me and say, you know, we wish you all the luck in the world. They pat me on the back. And in a bit of a patronizing way, you know, I'd kind of look at them and say, I don't need luck. I just got to get to work here and get up at, you know, in those days I was getting up at 3 and 4 in the morning. Mostly I couldn't sleep because I was scared to death.
Well, you didn't show it at all.
And then, you know, later on I tell people I get up early, I can't sleep at night because I can't wait to get up in the morning and go to work.
When we come back, Clint Peck tells us how a community of friends and family helped Yellowstone Cellars and Winery become a reality.
We are supported by Zonta Club of Billings, dedicated to advancing women's education, equality, health, and wellness, providing grants for community agencies, student scholarships, local nonprofit assistance, and awareness and education for domestic violence and human trafficking.
You also had a lot of community support. I've been down to the winery, and people have been just wonderful friends to you.
Yes, and I'm not going to name those friends because they know who they are.
Yes.
I've got dear, dear friends that offered a lot of support, a lot of criticism, constructively, I will say, and just helped me along the way. And it does take that. You know, I often say I started the winery on the friends and family plan. I had a cadre of people that I think believed in me, believed that I could make this work. And quite frankly, I'm looking at one of those people across this studio right now in you, Stella, that, you know, I remember the day you tasted some of my very first wines and you said you were pleasantly surprised.
And I was very much. It was down at the Rex, and you had brought samplings of your wines that you had made, and you did a great job. And that's what I see with your winery, is you work really hard. You don't say whoa when the going gets rough, and you keep moving forward, and you're that person.
At every juncture, I have to give credit to my brother Ken and his wife Jill, because they did allow me to make my first four vintages, basically, at their winery in Washington. And then once I got my bond and my permitting for the winery here in Billings, then I just basically transferred that product from their bond to my bond. So I was able to, when I opened the winery doors in November of 2010, I had inventory on hand, because the tough part of the wine business, not a whole lot unlike the cattle business, is by the time you harvest a grape to the time that you're ready to release that bottle of wine from those grapes, you're talking about typically a 3-year period on 3 to 4 year period on red wines.
So you have to be prepared for that waiting time.
And it's just like buying a heifer calf. By the time you get any income out of that heifer calf, you're going to be 3 years down the road.
And that's the mentality of your success, I believe.
You know what? I could probably write a book, Stella, on the similarities between raising cattle and producing beef and making wine out of wine grapes.
I want to work with you on that book.
That'll be fun.
So, okay, Montana. You know, you have a brother in Washington. Why Montana? This place doesn't have grapes. Wine in Montana does not go together for winemaking.
I am often asked, why did you build a winery in Billings? And I say, you know, come back, is because I live here. And yes, we're a ways away from the grapes. There are some attempts in Montana to produce wine grapes. I'll just say, I guess, politically, these are not the type of grapes that I'm choosing to make wine out of. My choice is to travel basically 750 miles to a region in the world that arguably is one of the top five areas of the world for wine grape production, and that's the Yakima Valley of Washington. And I do the old Montana thing. I drive my truck out there. I pull a trailer. Over the course of the year, this year, 2016, I'll bring back about 70 to 75,000 pounds of grapes in 6 grape runs. And I can haul about somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 14,000 pounds on my trailer.
So how does that work? Does the grape grower call you up and say, you know, the sugar level's at this stage and you better get over here? And how do you know when you need to drive that 750 miles?
The closer we get to harvest, the more I'm in contact with any of the 3 grape farmers that I buy grapes from. And we'll be in touch every 2 or 3 days. And there's sort of, by now, a little bit of this is intuitive. I begin, I know that my Merlot and my Syrah are going to be typically the earliest grapes. And that's kind of the beauty of this system, is that all the grapes don't ripen, all the varietals don't ripen at the same time. The Malbec and some of the Italian varietals and the Spanish varietal, the Tempranillo, will come on in the middle of harvest. And then the big Bordeaux grapes, the Cab Sauves, the Cab Franc, the Carmenere will come on sometime later in harvest.
How many different varietals do you make wine from?
Oh, I think this year I'll harvest, I think 11 different red varietals, and then I'll make probably 4 white varietals.
That's 15 wines that you're making.
Yeah.
And is 3,000 square feet and growing, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And it's. You know, we're not running, I mean, people often say you really need to expand your winery, and I come back and I say, you know what, I'm going to let the next guy expand, because I'm very comfortable in the space that we have.
What's your production?
We're at about 2,800 cases per year now, ramping up. It from this production, we may be in the 3,200 to 3,400 case range.
That's quite impressive, Clint.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Well, you do have fun with it. Your Malbec was your first signature wine. I remember when that came out and everybody was buying it. In fact, you were producing it, selling it faster than you could make it.
Well, you know, and that's the, sometimes people think I'm a bit schizophrenic. And that's the problem between, because owning a boutique winery is that I have to wear the bean counter hat. I have to pay the bills, and the staff, typically, they like to get their paychecks on time. But I have to make sure that I have quality premium wines, and they do take time. You know, there's the old Paul Masson commercial that a lot of us remember, that there will be no wine before it's time.
Right.
And the bean counter in me is saying, you know, we need to bottle that wine, get it out of the barrels, and bottle it. And the winemaker in me says, you know what, let's just wait another month or two. So I have run out. In fact, this year I did run out of my 2013 Malbec. And I had people screaming and hollering at me that, hey, you know, when are you going to bottle the 2014? We did that, and quite frankly, I'll be honest with you, and you can come taste the 14. It might be a little young yet, and I'm telling people, you know what, you can buy this stuff, but I would suggest you put it in your cellar for 6 or 8 months or a year, because then it's really going to be a very, very nice wine. I mean, it's a good drinkable wine now, but in a year, it's going to be something special.
What a testimonial to your success. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yes.
You have staff, but one of the things you do very well is you bring the community in. I've been in there to help you bottle. What else do you do to bring people to help you to be there?
You know, one of the things I kind of built into my business plan early on is that I know this is the chagrin of some of the media people out there, but I don't buy a lot of advertising. I tend to put sort of that budgetary kind of line item more into community events and helping with fundraising for organizations and direct contributions to charitable organizations. Kind of try to key in on families helping out with those events. We have our grape stomp coming up, by the way. We need to plug that. It's the 24th of September, and it's, I think, our sixth grape stomp. And this year it's going to be a fundraiser for Relay for Life, and it's for Team Michaela, the daughter of one of my staff members.
You also have a music that comes to the winery.
Oh yeah. Oh, Stella, I learned early on that, you know, if you've got a public venue in Montana, you need two things. You need a patio in the summertime, and you need music. And we have live music. Now we have live music 3 nights a week. And we do, you know, part of our mission is to not just make premium wines, but to provide a winery experience. We were the first Montana-produced wine ever to be rated by a Wine Spectator, and that was we had an 88 on our 2010 Malbec, and then we got a 85 on our 2014 Chardonnay, and you know, that's nice to get those recognitions. My recognition, though, is when somebody walks into the winery and they want to taste wine and they go, wow, I just couldn't believe that we would find these kind of wines in Montana.
That's fantastic. What is the wine that you're most proud of that you have made over the years?
Well, probably it's the Malbec. You know, a lot of people equate Malbec with Argentina, and I've traveled a lot to Argentina, and I did do a little studying of winemaking with Malbec grapes in Argentina. Malbec is a Bordeaux grape, though. It's European in origin. And I harvest a lot of Malbec grapes. And it's a fun grape to make wine with. Part of it is because it's a very early maturing grape.
What is your style of wine? What do you want Clint Peck's wine to smell, to taste, and to feel like?
You know, that's you and I have debated this and talked about this question. And at the end of the day, there's a saying in the wine business, it is what it is. And I think our wines, I think my wines that I make, I think they are soft mouthfeel wines. I think they tend to be very fruit forward. They, without being big old fruit bombs in your mouth, they tend to be a little higher on the alcohol content. Although I say that, and my 2015 vintage is a little bit lower in alcohol content, and that has to do with the vintage of the year, typically. I think they're wines that are easy to drink as cocktail wines, but yet are good food wines as well, where we kind of bridge that between being able to sit down and say, you know, this wine has to have some food with it.
Final question. What's next for Clint Peck?
What's next? Holy cow. You know, next is harvest this year. I'm gearing up for harvest, but, you know, down the road, who knows, Stella? You know, my career life has kind of been divided into 5-year increments, and I'm into 6 years of this last increment, and who knows? I really want to do this some more. I'm having a good time with it as long as my health holds out. I don't see a lot of end in sight with what I'm doing right now. I've had people kind of kicking the tires at the winery, thinking that it might be a good business for them if I would want to sell. That's a very private thing. I think I'll probably stick with this. Maybe 3 or 4 or 5 more harvests, who knows. It might very well be a good wind down to retirement kind of a job. I have to say, my staff, you know, the greatest joy I get is watching my staff take conceptual ownership in the winery as well. And, you know, if I can make decent wines and get the heck out of their way, that's probably a good thing for me to do.
Empower them to move things forward.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Clint Peck, cheers to you, and just thank you for being with me in the studio today.
Hey, Stella, thanks for all your support.
The producer for Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region, is Jackie Yamanaka. Our theme music is by Parker Brown. For more information about this program and links, go to ypradio.org. I'm Stella Fong.